ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we here at the Shattered Lives radio show are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. And prior to the show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget that if you can't listen between 5 and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, you can listen at any time using our archival feature. And just be sure to look for our big red heart with the cracks as our signature graphic. And then our podcast and our blog is ready within 24 hours or so for your listening and reading pleasure. And so I just wanted to say good evening again, and it's a pleasure to be here as always, greeting my national audience and my co-host and my guest each week. It is such a pleasure for me to do this show, and it's always a learning experience, and it's just a labor of love. And that's how I want to put it, and that's how I like to start out. Before I bring my co-host and my guest in, I just want to make a couple of announcements. Tonight I am in a different location. I'm on a little mini vacation, but the show must go on, as they say. So we're doing it from a different location. I'm having a great time. And I just wanted to please put in my plugs for our dear friend and colleague, Susan Murphy Milano, who has about 3 months ago been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, multi-organ cancer, is in the unfortunate predicament of having no health insurance, and has given so much of her life and her efforts for many, many years saving other people. And now it seems her fate is in the hands of other people, and everything is controlled by insurance, which she does not have. And so that means we need to step up to the plate, and we need to try to help in any way we can. And although we do appreciate, you know, the many small donations, if anyone out there does have connections for people that have greater means than you and I, we also want to hear from them. You can send checks or cards to the P.O. Box, P.O. Box 14946 at Surfside Beach. Please do check out the conqueringcancer.me website. There is a fundraising site called yourcaring.com. There's also a Cafe Press site. There's the opportunity to buy her many books, including Holding My Hand Through Hell, that's coming out in a very short time in October. So please, please do try to help. Send us your connections, and we do want to hear from you. Now, I'd like to introduce Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity, my PR manager, my co-host, my friend. Thank you, Delilah, for being here with me tonight. It's a pleasure to have you, as always.
Oh, hi, Donna. It's always fun to be here, and totally appreciate the information about Susan. And I think what a lot of times people don't understand how victims advocates work, and especially it seems those who have a lot of clout or a lot of new innovative type ideas but seem to get the job done. Oftentimes organizations and so forth don't embrace that kind of an advocate. So they're kind of out there like the Lone Ranger doing their own thing, but being very effective as Susan did. And the thing that I want to get out there is in most cases, these people do not get paid. They make money by doing speaking engagements, by writing and selling books, by donations from the goodness of other people's hearts. But there is no paycheck, so there is no benefits to a job like that. There are no insurance benefits. So, right. You know, if you don't know of Susan and the work that she's done over the last 20 years, you should. And also look out for those advocates out there. There are a lot of them out there who are doing what they do out of the goodness of their hearts, and taking no pay for it. And anyone can be in the same situation. And believe me, it's very complicated. It's very convoluted. It's ridiculous what hoops you have to go through, you know, to get help for someone who has no insurance.
Right, and that's true. And I think people have the misconception that just because you may look good in your three-piece suit, that you're living high off the hog, and it couldn't be further from the actual truth. You know, so we want to, we want to say that any and all efforts are appreciated, so very appreciated. But you know, now is a time of urgency when this can help the quality of her life, the small as well as the big donations. Correct?
Right. Absolutely.
Right. Well, so we hope that situation will improve with regard to financially, and we know that her health, we're all praying that her health is going to improve with the many efforts medically that are going on as well. So with that, I want to say good evening to our esteemed guest, Derek Van Lucien, who is the president of RyanUnited.org. And Derek is a very experienced advocate in his own right, speaking of advocates, and the impetus for all of his efforts and what drives him was the very unfortunate and tragic experience of his younger brother, Ryan, at 8 years old, being abducted, sexually assaulted, sexually molested, and murdered by a repeat sex offender. And ever since then, Derek has devoted his life, or at least when he became a law enforcement officer some years later, and he's just the amount of things that he's done on behalf of his brother and those people who also are at the hands of sexual predators, which are far too many. It's just amazing. So I want to say, Derek, good evening, and thank you so much for being on Shattered Life. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Well, thank you. And I was just saying before the show came on that this is the first time that we have broached this topic, and believe me, with all of them, the many people that are sexual predators, and the one that seems to, the people that seem to hit the media the most are the cases that are the most egregious or the most outrageous. And I think in the location and the circumstances under which your brother Ryan, this happened to, it would have just, caused a national horror if everyone had heard about it. And before I have you go into what the organization does, or really to tell us a little bit about the family, I just wanted to acquaint people, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you have many, many functions for Ryan United, legislative advocacy. You gather resources and technology in the fight against sexual predators. You distribute educational materials. You're very active on the seminar circuit. You act as a liaison between victim families and law enforcement for those families that encounter the same situation. And you partner with other similar organizations such that, like I had said, that there are safety in, not only safety in numbers, but power in numbers,
right,
with respect to you joining together. So have I gotten those functions correct, Derek?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You really hit the nail on the head as far as what we do. You know, when my brother disappeared in 1987, it was one of those things where, you know, he was in our yard 1 minute and gone the next. He was taken right out of our backyard when he was 8 years old. And you know, never did we dream as a family that we would be facing what we did. But, you know, the repeat sex offender that took him was just out of prison for another crime against a child. And once we learned that, we came together as a family and decided that, you know, more needed to be done. More needed to be done for crime victims because, you know, we were just a normal family that was thrown into the criminal justice system. And back in 87, there weren't such things as crime advocates. And I'm so glad that you bring up victim advocates and the wonderful work that Susan has done because, really, they're the front lines in dealing with families like mine. And so we were kind of thrown into this thing. But we've created several programs that we provide around the country that not only educate law enforcement, but we've done several trainings with victim advocates and things like that to sort of, you know, let folks understand that their job makes a difference and what they do every day to help crime victims and respond to investigations. They make a difference and that they can help in reducing the crime victimization that goes on.
Yes, yes, indeed. And, you know, I think you have to consider yourself among those numbers. And it just happens to be that, you know, different victim advocates specialize in different areas depending upon, you know, what has happened in their particular circumstance. We don't go out and choose this, do we, Derek? It just happens to us.
You know, I was just in Georgia speaking to the Georgia Sheriff's Association and a bunch of, you know, law enforcement folks that are really dedicated to helping our communities and helping communities in Georgia stay safe. And I always ask, you know, during my presentation, I'm like, raise your hand if you got into this job for the money. And nobody raises their hand. And we didn't get into this job for money. We got into this job to help people. And that's, you know, what we do, you know, as law enforcement or victim advocates, we're on the front lines helping victims. And really that's what we need to, we need to get back to focusing on our efforts to do that. And I'm so pleased that a lot of communities have victim advocates, a lot of prosecutors' office do, but that would have helped our family back in 1987. We're doing real fine as a family right now, but, you know, that would
back then it was a different story, right? You know,
right,
can you paint
exactly.
for us a picture of, like, where is Libby, Montana? And tell us a little bit about your family and about your brother. What was he like in, you know, amongst the dynamics of the other members of the family, you know, before you lost him at such a young age?
Right. He was the youngest of four children. You know, I have a younger sister and an older sister, and it was kind of me in the middle and then Ryan. And Ryan was so full of life, you know, the short time that we had him in our family, he was so full of life, and he really loved the outdoors. And you know, he would constantly, you know, catch bugs and catch fish and just like a normal eight-year-old boy would do, you know. And he went out on his last day of summer before school started into our backyard. And, you know, little did we know that, you know, he would just disappear that day and that we would face that horrible tragedy. But, you know, we've all rallied around Ryan's memory, not only to make sure that, you know, his death was not in vain, but make sure that his memory is carried on and that people understand that, you know, he's fighting through us. We're fighting individually, but really he's fighting through us to make a difference. And he directs me every day where to go.
Well don't you find, Eric, that crime victim advocates generally, and ones that I've come across anyway, are generally, they come from families like yours who have suffered through something like this. I know, you know, the Kelsey Smith Foundation and several of the others that you work with, the advocates come from a situation that they've been put into that they went into blindly, just like you did, didn't know what they were doing, but had to learn really quick what worked and what didn't. So I find that all across the nation, there are so many families that have gone through terrible crimes, but they come out wanting to give back in some way. Why do you think that is, either one of you?
Well, you know, if I could answer that, you know, I think that crime victims, how they come out on the end, or how if they go through something tragic like we did, the only thing that gets them through is the services that they get in the beginning. And if they get good services by good victim advocates in the beginning, chances are, and statistically, and I'm kind of a numbers guy, so I like to look into this stuff, but statistically, more victims come out better in the end if they have immediate intervention, if they have the resources that are available to them. And so really, I think that crime victims kind of, if they've been through it and they've had a bad experience, and there was a lot of experiences that we had that were not negative, but we didn't have anybody to tell us what to do, or we didn't have anybody to intervene.
Right.
So really,
and you learned, yeah, you learned very quickly on your feet, you know, what was the lay of the land in terms of what was going to happen, what was the resources, and where you saw the gaps or you know, where you needed help. And, you know, I really do agree with you. I think if in the beginning, speaking as a homicide survivor, and I think most of our audience knows that, I was able to partake in two 6-week training courses at a couple different junctures in time that were very structured, and really it was the very start. Yours, Derek, when your brother was abducted, was that 87?
Yeah, 1987, August 31st, 1987, yeah.
Right. See, my dad was killed in 1981, and the trial didn't come up until 87, so ours was even earlier, and victim services were just beginning. And I really think that we've spoken about this before. Different people cope in different ways, even within the same, you know, family structure. It could be if you have five members of the family, five different ways of coping. And mine happened to be coming out in, you know, being an activist with respect to this, and that's how you get through it. And then, you know, I put it away for several years, concentrated on careers, and you know, it's always been a passion. But then I saw that there was another way to help, and, you know, luckily Delilah and her company and Susan were there to kind of help me reignite things, and I'm helping people in a different way. And I can see how you, this must, I don't know, I never get up in the morning and say, oh, my God, you know, how do I deal with this? There's always some new challenge and something that kind of reinvigorates this passion in me. I don't know if that's the same for you, Derek.
You know, and I really, you know, I always tell people in my lectures, I'm like, I'm a true example of divine intervention. And, you know, sometimes the police officers in the room will be like, oh, gosh, he's going to start passing out literature or something on religion. And really, you know, I believe that I'm a true product of divine intervention, because every time I tell myself that I'm on the wrong track, every time I tell myself that, you know, maybe you should just go back to the comfortable law enforcement career that you had and not, you know, just go back to that, I get a sign that I should be out doing what I'm doing. And really, it's through my brother that I'm able to do it. And sometimes it's difficult. I mean, sometimes you just want to throw up your hands and go, I can't beat the system. But really, you know, if you're passionate about it, if you really want to make a difference in people's lives, I mean, victim advocacy is the way to do it.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with you. I think it's always spoken to me ever since my dad. If there's any, you know, in any kind of tragedy, there's positive things that come out of it. And we've seen this with Susan and her cancer. It's a horrible it's a horrible thing to have happen, but yet we can see that there are a couple of really positive things that have happened. So we take that and we nurture that. But with respect to your particular situation, and then I want to get into some of the details of some of the other things that you do with Ryan United. In addition to the fact that this predator was on early release and a repeat offender, was able to get out and do this. What can you kind of paint the picture for us, Derek, in terms of what other circumstances might have existed about the environment? You said this was the day before Ryan was supposed to go to school. Now, was this did you have a big plot of land, a big backyard? Was it a situation where, maybe you couldn't see someone from the kitchen window entering the backyard if there was somebody walking through, or houses close together, that kind of thing? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a little ironic about our case because, this offender was released about 90 days before he abducted my brother. He was in our state prison in Montana for the abduction and rape of a 13-year-old boy. He did that crime in 1984. He held this little boy at knife point and raped this boy, and so he was put into our Montana State Prison in 1984. He got out in 3 years for good behavior for that crime against that child, and they put him into the community with no notification. And immediately he started, and we know he started to look for his next victim immediately when he got into the community. And, there was a creek behind our house and where Ryan played quite a bit. And he saw Ryan about 2 weeks prior to Ryan being taken. And he watched him and he watched our family's patterns and, different things like that. And what
Did
we know is that...
Did he confess these details? Is that how you learned that he was stalking him?
Yeah, absolutely. A predator like this guy usually documents these things, and the studying that I've done and the research I've done on his type of predator, they document this stuff and they write it down. So we were able later on to find out that he had looked at our family for quite a long time, and that August 31st, 1987, our yard in the backyard was not very big. I mean, you could walk 10 feet across it and be in, down by a creek. And that's where Ryan was when he was taken. He was taken right from our backyard. So our case was unique in that Ryan was taken at 10:30 in the morning. And we didn't have one witness that saw him being taken, that heard, we had one lady that came forward that thought she heard a child screaming, and that kind of helped us lay the timeline. But really, it was so unique in that it wasn't witnessed, and Ryan literally disappeared, and we didn't know what had happened to him. But it was not like we had a big expansive piece of land. It was a predator.
He snuck up from behind him, most likely when he was playing in the creek, and it's kind of snatched him or whatever.
Yeah, as far as we know, he probably said something to him to get him to come closer and then probably took him that way. But we know it was forcibly. We know that Ryan put up a fight and we know those things, and sometimes it's hard to talk about. But we people always ask me, is there anything that could have saved your brother? Whether it be like our Rad Kids program that talks about child safety and I tell people there's probably one thing that could have saved my brother, and that is if they would have left that guy in prison where he should have been. They shouldn't have let him out in 3 years for a crime like that. So, really, our Ryan United, our organization, focuses on those holding offenders accountable and making sure that they're going to spend the time that's appropriate for the crime. 3 years for the rape of a 13-year-old boy isn't appropriate.
That's unconscionable. It really is. And I'm wondering, as you told this story, where the breakdown began to happen was that your state did not have the checks and balances in place with regard to notification of families, and that's where it started to go wrong with this guy getting out and then not noticing, notifying you. Is that right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, back then we didn't have things called community notification. We didn't have things like the sex offender registry. We didn't
right.
have things like the Amber Alert. Those things didn't exist. But really, as a family, we took a look at that, and even, you know, law enforcement at the time was like, how can this guy be in our community? And nobody knew about it, you know. So
mm-hmm.
my point with law enforcement when I speak to them is always, you know, it's not to criticize what they do or what has been done. It's like, how far have we come since 1987? We've come a long ways, and we've got some work to do still. But really,
right.
we've come a long way since then.
Well,
well
I can see. A question, what specific things do you see that have changed for the better since that
right.
time? Or are there even things that have gotten worse in terms of you know, the predators themselves and their accountability and our children going missing and being abducted? Do you see changes both directions?
Absolutely. That's a great question, because really I see that we've come
mm-hmm.
a long ways in the way we manage offenders, the way that states are. I've been in two states this week. I was in Iowa and then over in Georgia talking at both conferences that focus on sex offender management. And I think law enforcement has gotten more aware of what we need to do as far as managing offenders. But
mm-hmm.
where I think the difference is that we've introduced something called the Internet. And in 1987, it was about the guy that was hiding in the bushes waiting to grab a child, like it happened in our case. Now,
right.
These days, with the advent of the Internet and the smartphones or the iPhone, like I'm talking to you on now, we have access to things immediately. And predators sometimes use those resources to, you know, entice kids or to lure children. So, you know, we're dealing with a whole different sort of predator now, in that I can, you know, if I was a predator, I could sit behind my computer in total sort of hiding and be able to portray myself as a different person and be able to lure a child that way. I don't necessarily have to
right.
hang out at the park or anything like that. So I see that we've come a long ways. We have mandatory minimum sentences, which I am a strong proponent of. I think we need to have those in place.
Mm-hmm.
We have things called civil commitment that after these child molesters and sex offenders, they serve their time. There's something that's called civil commitment that kicks in, that actually commits them to the state or some kind of facility that's able to deal with them after their prison term's over. But still, a lot of states I see, we release those people back into society after their time is done. So we really need to grab a hold of that and figure out what we're going to do with those folks that are out in our communities.
Well, Derek, do
yeah.
you, or your organization, do you handle cases, and I know that, you know, we're seeing a lot of this, and maybe it's just coming to the forefront because people are becoming more educated about it, but with human trafficking,
right.
There's so many different ways that these predators work and operate and get their hands on the kids, whether they're young or whether they're, you know, older teens or even older than that. But do you see things differently now in terms of human trafficking than you saw back then?
Yeah, and I think it's gotten to a whole new level as far as human trafficking goes. And I think that, you know, I think technology contributes to that, although I don't want to paint technology to be a bad thing. You know, I'm on Facebook. My kids are on Facebook. You know, my
right.
daughter just tried to unfriend me because I saw, you know, some pictures on there that I didn't agree with, you know. But it's a way for us to track our children. But really, I think what's contributed to the human trafficking trade is technology, in that we've got more of an ability to communicate with a wider range of people. So those,
yeah, it's a double-edged sword, that's for sure, right?
Right?
Yeah, it's more
lucrative, so.
Do you know that I think maybe last year when I was at a conference, happened to be with Mark Klass, and he was saying how just in the span of, you know, when his daughter was abducted, and it was in the early 90s, and the way they got the word out then was still the licking envelope, put the stamp on a letter method. And that's
right.
Not that long ago. And you think of, you know, and they were still doing that and sending out, you know, so it's just the growth of communication since then is just, you know, incredible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree with you.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, with respect to, you know, this show focuses on or tries to tell the story about the aftermath of the crime, not
right.
so much what happened in the crime. And, you know, what happened irrespective of the actual details of the crime? What happened with your family? What kind of domino effect, what impact did it have beyond that, Derek?
You know, I always refer to it as the spider web effect.
Okay.
You know, you have the core, you have the family that's, you know, obviously affected by the crime and what occurs, but really it spider webs itself out to not only the community, but, you know, law enforcement is affected by it. I mean, I still keep in touch with the detective that worked my brother's case, and in fact, I talked to him 2 days ago, and he says, you know, every time I call him, he said, it takes me right back there to that time, you know, and
mm-hmm.
he says, when I talk to you, I get this feeling, you know, and so it is a spider web effect. I, you know, to give you an example, I was with the state of Montana Division of Criminal Investigation for 10 years, and we were doing a court security survey with all 56 counties to secure their courts, and I was assigned to Libby, Montana, where my brother was killed, and I walked into their courthouse and talked to the clerk of district court, and I was all ready to do this security survey with her, and I looked up at her, and she was crying. And I said,
yeah.
Gosh, I hope I didn't say anything to offend her, but I didn't understand why she was crying. And I said, are you okay? And she says, yeah. She said, this is hard for me. And I said, what's going on? And she says, I remember you. I remember your brother. And she says, I didn't know how I would face you, you know. So that's that example of how it just weaves that web amongst
mm-hmm.
people. And that, you know, people know, you know, who you are. Oh, you're the guy that his brother was abducted and murdered. But, you know, as far as family members, each of us deal with it in a different way. You know, we've all dealt with it the way we're comfortable. My level of comfort is to be able to reach out to people and to be able to advocate for people.
Mm-hmm. And are your family members supportive of that? Your family really is it takes a pro stance in what you're doing.
Right. Yeah,
well,
they do. I mean, I think they're all supportive of that. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, everybody handles it different. I've chose to carry
right.
the torch here, you know, and it's one of those things where you kind of half of what happens to you. And I've chose to carry the torch, and my mom's carrying that torch with me. And,
uh-huh.
You know, all of us we're doing different things at different levels. And, you know, that's kind of where we are,
right.
you know, and,
mm-hmm.
Some of us are on the front line, some aren't, so.
Right, I understand that. Now, it seems like maybe this is an obvious question, but I don't know. Because of the circumstance of what happened with your brother, did that serve as the impetus for you to go into law enforcement in the first place?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, that really got me interested in, you know, my career in law enforcement. You know, I went down
right.
a wrong path after he was killed, and but really it got me interested in that, and I think it's, you know, that's the reason for where I am today, because I've been able to do that career, and I've been able to, you know,
help other
people.
And has that opened doors for you, Derek, or do you think it's been a hindrance at some points with you being in law enforcement and doing what you do?
You know, I think it's helped me, because I think I can relate both to the victim side and the law enforcement side, you know, and I think that that helps me kind of sort of build the bridge in between.
Yeah. Well, I would think it would be positive for sure. One of the things I was most interested in, and I'm seeing that, you know, your seminars are not just to, you know, get up in front of the podium and talk for an hour. They're like, you know, a 6-hour ordeal in many of the different, shall I say, modules that you do. And one of them that really caught my eye, because I think it's kind of a very much overlooked group, is that you do specific programming targeting dispatchers who, we were just talking, maybe the first line of defense. They don't just answer the phone, right?
Right. Is that the sex offender in your backyard, the one that you're talking about, or
so,
the
yes.
dispatcher
believe,
training, right?
Is that the one that, that's geared for them, or at least includes them? Because I have never read or heard of anyone targeting, but including them specifically. And like I say, many times crimes have happened because they misconstrued the urgency of a call and have cost people's lives.
Right. I think our public safety communicators are like on the front lines of, you know, obviously they take the calls, they dispatch the officers, they're kind of on the front line. So we've created training specifically for them to be able to, you know, respond correctly when they get that call. You know, how do they respond? What do they need to do?
Well, can you give us an example, a scenario of what they should do in that situation?
Well, if they have a parent on the other end of the line that calls 911, that says, hey, my child's missing, they should establish the information of, you know, what they need to tell the officers, what that parent's feeling. They're going to have to be that first line person that's going to respond to calls like this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we try and give them, you know, we try and give them information on, okay, if a parent says this, what does it mean? You know, you have to dispatch officers immediately. Those are all things that we need to do.
Right, and they're making split-second decisions, you know, very, you know, akin to maybe like air traffic controllers. They're right there and they need to respond immediately, and sometimes they do so correctly and incorrectly. So I think it's wonderful that you're gearing that toward them. And another thing that I think probably proves the integrity and the strength of your organization is that you've partnered with many other very impressive organizations, such as Molly Bish, Project Safe Childhood, Family Watchdog, Neville, and I was wondering if you could maybe explain that a little bit. Is this Neville? It's some type of a portable parental monitoring and management product for children from 4 to 17. When I think of monitoring, I think of that little baby monitor, you know. But what kind of a monitoring device do you have that's appropriate for someone from 4 to 17 years?
Well, the Meville product that we have on our website is actually a computer monitoring thing where you can determine where your child goes on the internet, what site gone to. Yeah, it's a monitoring thing, and actually you can set parameters for security on that website. And if your child goes, let's say that, you know, for example, I have it for my Liam, he's 8 years old, he can get on my computer, he can go to his desktop that the Meville software provides, he can go on the internet, but I've set the parameters for his security. So if he travels outside of that security, then I get a text message on my phone that he's traveled outside of that security. So that's really what the Meville product is about, and it's a very effective thing. I use it for all my kids, my 20-some year old.
Has he unfriended you, Dick?
What's that?
Has he unfriended you?
No, my oldest hasn't unfriended me, but she doesn't use the Meville software anymore because you know, we've talked to, you know, and she's actually in Portland, so you know, she understands the computer safety, but we use it for our little kids around the house. So.
Oh, that's great, and I think I got the sense in reading over the material that one of your main thrusts is the fact that you're trying to stay on top of the best and latest technology to kind of outsmart these predators. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, besides the internet monitoring device, what other types of technologies might you speak of, you know, in those kinds of categories?
You know, there are several different things out there. There's, you know, website monitors, there's things like that. But, you know, what I found out is that, you know, we're always one step behind what the predators are doing, you know, and
mm-hmm.
People always say to me, they say, okay, how can I protect my child on the internet? Know what they're doing. Know where they're going. Know who their friends are. Know what they're, you know, I have a brother-in-law that just put in a bunch of computers in his brand new house. And each child has a computer with the internet in every room. But he's not, you know, he said, well, how am I going to monitor this? You know, and so we've tried to bring that technology to him, but really, it's known about what your kids are doing, and it's not just online. It's in everyday stuff. You have to talk to your kids. That's how you protect them.
Right, your ability to communicate with them and talk about trust and, you know, and who not to trust and that kind of thing. You're right. It's so very important. What are there particular pieces of legislation that you have helped gotten? To pass that you're particularly proud of? I mean, compared to 87 in Montana, I'm sure you've made many, many inroads. And maybe there's certain states that definitely lag behind, or there's certain states that are model states in terms of what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, there are. And every time I go to a state, I kind of assess what they're doing. I was just in Iowa, and they have their struggles, but the state of Iowa is doing a really good job on sex offender management. You know, the best state I've been in is probably Colorado. They have their sex offender management board where they have a board of multidisciplinary people that they manage the sex offenders. So it's everybody at the table. It's law enforcement, it's prosecutors, they have everybody at the table to manage offenders in there. So I think that that's an effective program. Sometimes we pass these laws that are community feel-good laws that don't work for the end user. Law enforcement sometimes can't enforce the laws that we use. Sometimes corrections can't enforce the laws that we use. So we push with Ryan United to have a common sense criminal justice approach in that we're mm-hmm. passing laws that make sense to the end user. In other words,
and are functional, right? Yeah, that you can really do something. Something with them.
They're counterproductive, and the end user, like law enforcement or corrections, really can't use them, and they can't enforce them, and so they become those counterproductive laws.
Right. And, you know, with the economy such as it is, I'm sure you get the familiar refrain from people, well, that's nice, but we just can't afford that. And it seems as if, in what I was reading, that you have some particular strategies that people can implement immediately, even if they're on limited budgets, through those partnerships with other organizations. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's nonprofit organizations. Ryan United's one of them. The Summer Thompson Foundation from Florida. Actually, I'm meeting with Dina Thompson, Summer's mom, tonight. And it's organizations like ours that are able to help law enforcement out and help them with those resources that they really need in order to track these people and in order to find these people and in order to figure out in their community what works and what doesn't. So really it's the partnerships with those other organizations that make a difference. And sometimes, you know, law enforcement is a little bit like, it's a nonprofit organization. I don't know how we can partner with it. But what we've concentrated on is being able to make sure that we have resources for law enforcement to tap into with us. So I've tried to forge ahead and to kind of collectively get other organizations together and to really help law enforcement with what they need to do every day.
Right, and they're the people that are the grassroots organizations and really know what's going on in their communities. And, you know, maybe people are apprehensive to approach law enforcement, but they'd join forces with the nonprofit. So it would only make sense to me for people to do that. What do you see if you look in turn, if you do an overview with respect to progress from where you've come now? Now you're still based in Montana, correct?
Are
you
still living in Montana? That's right. We're in Helena, Montana. Yep.
Now, what can you say? You know, since this happened in your own home state, how much progress have you made as a result of, you know, putting your brother's case out there, you know, over time? Is Montana now one of the model states?
No, we're not. We're far from that. And unfortunately, you know, as hard as we push, we're not the model state. And,
why is that?
Because, you know, I used to work for the organization that does that stuff, you know, and I kind of sort of got my own agenda in that I had to be able to help more people, and they sort of saw that as a different thing. So, it's one of those things where we're not the model state. I think we're doing a fairly good job, but there's things that we need to tighten up with, obviously. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you find, Derek, that some of the victim service organizations or even within the legal community and the justice system, do you think it's getting, there's like specialized areas, kind of like the medical community? If you have a sore throat, you go to this doctor and then he refers you to that one. And are you seeing the same thing like within our judicial system? It seems like somewhere along the line, there were so many other layers put into the process of, you know, bringing charges even against a perpetrator or in the process of the investigation. There seems to be just so many more layers that are they really necessary?
Right.
Well, yeah, and with sex offenders, it's a whole different ballgame. I just told folks in Georgia, I'm like, you know, it's a different... It's not like you're investigating a burglary or something. It's a whole different ballgame when it comes to these folks. So we are getting specialized units to deal with them. Iowa, I was just in Iowa this week, and they have a sex offender task force that's at the ready. Georgia has a sex offender task force to deal with these offenders. So it does take a specialized type of person, type of organization to be able to deal with these offenders. So.
And is it frequently those states that I'm just wondering about the regional or national stats in terms of how many predators are actually out there these days, and or those that are being tracked in particular states, you know, Florida, wherever, are they doing a better job? Those that seem to have, you know. The numbers are higher versus in other areas, or is that not so?
You know, it has to do with population, and yeah, obviously the more people you have, the more offenders there's going to be. But you know, Florida is the one state that, you know, really they've had some horrible cases, you know, that have happened, and so I think they've heightened their awareness, and I think they're establishing programs and doing a better job at trying to track offenders, but it all comes down to money and manpower, and without either of those, agencies are going to struggle to be able to really be able to do a good job.
Right. But in the scheme of things, when we talk about last week, we were just talking about, the adult missing, and in comparison to the adult missing, don't you think overall law enforcement would look at, you know, catching a sexual predator of a child, that would be a higher priority than someone that goes missing that's an adult male? They're just going to put more into it, or at least you hope they do.
Right. Initially they are, you know, and we try and teach on adult missing too, and that, you know, if there are circumstances that just doesn't look right, that they respond, you know, accordingly, and they apply some resources to it. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, if they're an adult person, you know, law enforcement sometimes tends to think, and I'm guilty of it myself being in law enforcement, that, hey, they have the right to be missing, you know, what can we do, you
sure.
know? So we're hoping that we change that mentality, because there are, you know, I work with families all over the country that have had kids that have, you know, gone missing as adults. And we're hoping that they, you know, law enforcement steps up and puts the resources into those cases too.
Right. What are your current goals that you're working on or focusing on overall right now?
Well, we have our victims camp that's out in Montana. We're hoping to bring families that have had a child abducted or murdered out to Montana and show them a piece of God's country. We'll have.
Is it like a retreat, Derek?
Yeah, it's sort of like a retreat, but we're going to have them on horses. We're going to have them fishing. We're going to have them doing a whole bunch of different things. We're going to have therapists that are there on staff for us, and we've really been in the planning stages of that. And
that sounds great.
Yeah, and literally David Letterman's place butts right up next to the land that we're going to be using. So we're hoping that, you know, that really has a good effect on victims and victim families and things like that. So.
And that's a first-time venture.
It's really important for these families.
It's taken a lot of planning and a lot of doing, but it's come together. So.
And that's all raised through donations?
Yeah, that was strictly donations. You know, Ryan United we don't take any government money right now, so we're strictly on donations. You know, and it's kind of tough to operate that way sometimes.
Oh, sure. That is for sure. When you compare, you know, since you partner with many similar types of organizations throughout the U.S., what is it that you feel in your mind sets Ryan United apart from the others, or what you do differently, or what's particularly unique in that if someone is looking to get involved in this issue and you know, we all want good volunteers, what is it that you can tell our audience about your organization that is different or sets you apart from the others?
Well, you know, I get that. You know, people are always like, what sets you apart? I think that we try and provide solutions for people. I think we try and provide answers for people. And I really think that, you know, as far as sex offender management goes, I've studied it since 1989. I mean, I spoke to our state legislator in 1989, 2 years after my brother was abducted, you know, and so I think I've
You've
really
been doing
established...
it a long time. Yeah,
I think I've established myself in that I've seen the course of events that have happened in our country, you know, trying to manage offenders and realizing what they are and what they aren't, and really
mm-hmm.
trying to manage them. And I think what we provide with Ryan United is a common sense approach when it comes to managing offenders. You know, we don't have law. I always have people tell me that, oh, you should lock them away forever. You know, you should stick them on a desert island. You should, blah, you know, this and that and the other thing. But we can't do that. Our society doesn't work that way. Our system doesn't work that way. So we have to find ways to manage offenders within the community. So I think we're able to provide that. I think we're able to give people an avenue, law enforcement, corrections, to say, okay, what do we do? What is the best approach to this? And I think, you know, it sets us apart from other, you know, organizations, but it unites us with a lot of organizations that have mm-hmm. that same mission. And my goal with Ryan United is to be there for as many people as I can to include mm-hmm. other organizations that are trying to do what we do.
Like you do a lot of traveling all over, right?
Yeah, about three weeks out of the month, I'm on the road just doing something, either conferences or trying to meet with folks and really trying to drive this mission forward. So,
Yeah, well, it certainly is very, very worthwhile. And with respect to the amount of, you know, the funds that you do get, are they used for, are they earmarked for specific purposes or just wherever they happen to be needed?
We do our Are You Safe Communities program, where we go out and we teach communities not only about sex offender management or what sex offenders are and what they aren't, but we also teach communities about child abduction prevention, and you know, we offer that program to several communities. So some of our money gets used for our Are You Safe programs. We offer, you know, money to crime victims who are, you know, are struggling. You know, they don't know what the system's about. We try and provide avenues for them if they need financial help. So, you know, it's one of those things where I'm the president and founder of Ryan United, but I don't take a salary from it. You know, it's something
right.
that I do. You know,
we know that very well. You know, and we can't commend you any more than, you know, anyone else, because all of our colleagues are in a similar situation. They have
right.
a calling. You know, and I rarely ask this, but I'm just wondering, you know, we're approaching a national election, and I have to tell you, I'm very lukewarm about it with respect to the choices that we have. And I'm just wondering, in particular speaking regarding Obama or the contender, how do we get, what's your opinion, Derek, in terms of how do we get politicians to pay attention to any kind of crime victimization so that we can get more help?
And you
have
just a little over a minute.
How
do we get them to pay attention? Well, you know, I've tried, you know, many times, and I've had politicians who ignore me, I've been fairly effective at looping them into this, how it affects them, you know. And really, there's two reasons that people will get involved with what I do, in that it directly affects them, or they've had somebody else that's been affected by it. They know a child that's been abused, or they know a family that's been through, you know,
right.
an abusive situation. And somehow it compels them to say, wait a minute, I support this. But really, it's a tough thing, and I love animals. I have a whole lot of animals at my
uh-huh.
house. You know, I'm like, I feel like I'm Noah sometimes. You know,
whatever we can do to help.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, sometimes, you know, folks are more willing to contribute to causes for animals than they are for kids, I've had to face that myself, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know. You have a chance to protect your community
right.
and save a child,
right.
but you won't do it because...
Well, isn't that the truth? And it's kind of a sad commentary in a way, even though animals are important. But, Derek, since our time is vastly going by, can you please stay in touch with me so that we can collaborate more? And also, can you give us your contact information before we have to sign off? People want to get in touch with you?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, people can go to RyanUnited.org to see what we're about. They can contact me directly on my cell phone at 406-439-8748. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter and all that good stuff.
Are there opportunities to volunteer?
Absolutely. You know, we're always looking for folks to pick up our Are You Safe Communities program and go with that. So.
Well, that is wonderful. So I have to say, I'm sorry our time is running short. Thank you so much for being on. Look for our blog and podcast within the next day or so, and we will stay in touch. Thank you, Delilah, very much for a wonderful show. And we'll see you next Saturday, everyone. Good evening.
Thank you.